This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson, and joining me are Garrett Wright.
What up? Oh, all right. I'm just on one today. I'm sorry, guys.
And Brock Rahm.
Cool. That absolutely makes sense. You can absolutely do that.
Well, there's Brock's intro.
I hope you're enjoying a great start to 2022. Today, we have co-founder Simon Dixon of Dixon Baxi to give a creative pep talk of sorts. I've been following Dixon Baxi for a few years and love what they do for the community. We want you to find your voice in this space, and Simon provides an unfiltered perspective on cultivating creativity.
Do y'all want to clap on five?
Yep.
Nope. We're going to do the next five.
Sorry, I thought you meant 05.
05.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show. My name is Garrett Wright. I want to start out with a big thank you to APM Music for donating the tracks we use on this podcast. Also, a reminder that this podcast is an extension of the sports creative community on Slack. So if you're hearing this and not a member of that community yet, you should head over to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free.
We believe in a world of rapid change. There has never been a greater need to future-proof brands. We're trusted by Hulu, Audible, AT&T, British Land, Capital One, Premier League, WWE, Eurosport, Netflix, and AC Milan, just to name a few. Today, we have Simon Dixon of Dixon Baxi here with us, and I just read a couple of your clients off the front of your website, Simon, and excited to get into who you are, what you do, and how you've built such a fantastic brand over the 20 years. So first off, welcome to the show and thanks for joining us.
Hey, Justin, many thanks. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
So I'm hoping to make this a little bit of a creative pep talk. And the reason I have invited you on is because you're great about sharing your process, your background, what you believe, what you stand for. And I think seeing just from my perspective, it's a fresh perspective on the industry, and there's a lot of quiet, like, I'm going to hold this stuff in my corner over here and not share it with anybody, but you're very much the opposite. You've done monographs trying to share your process and who you are. So I'd like to dig in a little bit and help people understand a little bit about that, but also the brands you work with, how you approach your work, how you lead the people in your office going to and the change that you've gone through with the pandemic and work from home and some of those kinds of things. So can we just start with a little bit of a background on you and how you initially got into the industry?
Yeah, sure. I started very young. I went to college when I was 15 because I had quite a bohemian background, I guess. And I studied lots of things. I did fine art courses and different things, but ultimately found graphic design. And I think I've always been a visual person, but I'm also quite a pragmatic person. So I like the idea of communicating to and for people as opposed to just creating for myself. And I found design, you know, it suits the nerd in me, that sensibility. I like the details, the craft and that side of things. And so I studied graphic design provincial level, not a particularly good course, but met some really interesting people on it. And two of which I created my first design agency when I was 19. So I actually started professional creativity with an agency in my last year of college. And we used to do a lot of, you know, rave flyers and music and stuff like that, record labels. And we actually had an office in the back of a record shop. And we used to trade design work for that office. And that kind of got us in the game. And because it was very disposable, we could make a lot of things very quickly. And I've always learned by doing. I think I've just been one of those people. And then, you know, went on and ran much, much bigger agencies over a number of years, both in the UK and America and around the world. And then about 20 years ago, myself and a guy called Apoorva Baxi, who I'd met in that journey, decided to try and do something different, a kind of reaction to running large agencies, working internationally. We wanted to get back to something quite intimate. So we started Dixon Baxi.
That's fantastic. So you talked a little bit about intimacy. Your group, I think, is somewhere in the 35 to 40 range of people. How do you approach and keep your voice? I'm assuming that's probably a big part of why you wanted to keep it small and intimate so that you still kind of had a hand in that in the work that you're doing.
Yeah, to a certain degree, you're right. I think it's 42 of us now, so it's a nice size. It gives us enough muscle to work on substantial kind of international brand change programs, but also you know everybody, you're very close to them, and you know, particularly over the pandemic, keeping the culture and the spirit of why we do what we do is really important to us, because there's many ways of creating. You can be a specialist, a generalist, you could be an individual, you could be freelance, you could work for a large network agency, you could have your own small agency. And I've always figured that it's the principles, the things you care about that drive your work. And when you're doing it with other people, it's a shared set of principles, and the way you look at creativity is the way you express yourself as a team. So the size we found means we can all share that endeavor. We can all share that the ideas that we care about. And it gives us flexibility. We're agile, we're nimble, we're constantly learning. And it means we can be on the front foot and change before the world changes us, which is really important to us. I think it's better to change when things are going well than change because you've been told to or the world has changed around you. So we like this idea of being on the front foot, and both the size and the methodology and the way we look at creativity suits that, I think.
Your tagline is be brave. And that feels like that fits 100% what you were just talking about of being willing to change before you are forced to change or your world changes around you. Can you give us a little background on how that came to be?
Yeah, I suppose what it is it's a rallying cry. Myself and Apoorva, we've been very lucky in our careers to do a lot of different things. And you have to, keep re-inspiring yourself. And it's very easy to get to good now, to kind of do okay work, to get to a place where you feel satisfied. But that's not what excites me. Creativity that is pushing boundaries and pushing myself and the team personally, I think is really important. So being brave is just us saying to ourselves, it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to go somewhere new. It's okay to be self-determined in the way you look at creativity. And we're very explicit with our clients. So we tend to work with clients and companies and individuals in those companies who want greater change. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where our work is on behalf of real people. So obviously we work for clients and we work for brands, but really we work for tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people all over the world. And I want to take great creativity to everybody. I like that feeling. I think the more people that use our work, the more they interact with it, the better, to be honest. So you better be on your game if you're going to design for that many people. So the be brave is us telling ourselves to be better, to challenge ourselves and to try and be more inventive.
What do you think holds people back from being brave?
It's a number of things. Fear is one of them. Imposter syndrome is another, uncertainty is another. A lot of people get told what they should and shouldn't do as well. So sometimes you kind of cut through the bullshit and the kind of nonsense of how people talk about our industry, and how people talk about career journeys, how people talk about how you should work to something that suits you, however you want to do it. And I think often that can hold people back because they perceive their journey to be a certain way because that's what they've been told. And you know, I've always felt that the more self-determined you are, the better your work will be because the more it suits you. So, yeah, I suppose it circulates around that space, really, in terms of what drives that thinking, I think.
Yeah, that's great. I'm looking at this line graph that you guys had posted where it talks about boring, safe, and uncomfortable. And you like to start uncomfortable because then you come back a little bit closer to safe, and that you have a dot there that says just right. So when you're starting a project, how do you get to the uncomfortable spot first? Like where do you go in order to feel like you're getting to the uncomfortable spot so you can land in the right spot?
It's a good question. I've just actually been doing a creative session with some of the team on a project that's in the phase where we're about to present really what the brand is at some point very soon to the client. And we've had very explicit conversations about when we look at the work, does that feel derivative? Have I seen that somewhere else? Is that explicitly reflecting the strategy? Is it surprising me? Do I love it? Do I care about it? you know, it's asking yourself pointed questions, because if you say, is that work good enough? The answer is usually yeah. But if you say, is that original? It's a much harder bar to reach. And actually, it's very hard to be truly original because we all get the same influences. But yeah, we're very explicit with ourselves about where we are. And being uncomfortable means that you have to stretch yourself mentally and put yourself in a position to be fragile and to be open. Because if when you're doing new things, it doesn't always look good. It doesn't always work initially. Now, we've got lots and lots of experience that tells us how things work, and we're confident that we're going to get to the end result really well. But there is a period of, I don't know, kind of virgin clean space that I really love when we start a project, which is, imagine if we did this, imagine if we did something new. And that is uncomfortable. You've got to be able to fall down, and you have to create a safe space where people are willing to be honest about the work. It's there's a lot of conversation now about how people communicate about creativity, and there's a lot of sensitivity about that. But I think you have to be radically honest about what you believe is good, bad, or indifferent, and be able to talk about that without feeling like you're it's a personal attack, or you're downgrading somebody. We design and talk about the work on behalf of the people we design for and the project rather than the individual. And it helps have, you know, more explicit conversations. And it's just always in the air. We're constantly, whenever we feel we're settling, we go, well, this feels like we've done this before. We need to push. And that's an instinct more than anything.
That's awesome. And so when you mentioned original there, and there's some elements of your inspiration and your influences, I feel like I've heard a lot of content, well, everything's been done before, so there's nothing new that you can create. How would you respond to that?
Well, it's not true. It's not true, is it? Like, when I started the agency, there was no Google as we know it. There were no smartphones. There were no applications. There was no TikTok. There was no COVID. There was no Donald Trump in terms of being the president. You know, so if you imagine what could be, and your mind is open, and you look for something new, it'll always be there. You know, Elon Musk created Tesla cars because of his ego and a drive to do something. And that's because he believed that he could do that. If he just listened to everybody else who were, oh, well, you can't improve the car, the system's in place, blah, blah, blah. Just don't listen to people. The world is there for you to create. The world is there for you to change. And I think that's the smart people, the people who are creative, the ones who care, will go change the world. The ones who say that everything's been done are the ones who'll turn around and be obsolete.
When you got started, you outlined some values with Apova, and you still stuck with those values today. And I'm looking at this slide that you have up of who you'll be and who you won't be. Can you talk a little bit about how you landed on your values and tried to put a stake in the ground to help not only you, but your team understand who you were going to be and who you wanted to be?
Yeah, when we started the agency, we were reacting to having run a much bigger agency of over 200 people with other people. And we've done a lot of cool stuff, but there's a lot of, I think you said earlier, there's a lot of bullshit in the industry. There's a lot of negativity. There's a lot of people telling you what you should do. There's a lot of presumption of how people can create. And we just don't believe that. We believe there's many ways of being a creative person. So we like the idea of simplifying things and getting back to basics and saying, look, we want to be honest. We want to be open and transparent. And as much as possible, we try to do that. You know, we're very honest with our clients and ourselves. I don't want to cheat things. That, you know, hard work, drive, persistence, and energy is required to make excellent work. It's the same if you're an athlete or an American football player or a basketball player. You can't cheat that. You've got to put the time in to get brilliant. You know, we want to be self-determined. We want to design for everyone. We want to design for people all over the world. I like the power of democratized design. And there's a huge amount of difference in the world and a distinct lack of celebration of difference and the fact that we're all made up in different ways, but we share a lot of common things. And we wanted to root back to the things that matter to people and the things that specifically matter to us in terms of how we create. And we're just always honest with the team, good and bad. So, you know, when COVID happened, we were honest about, we weren't entirely sure what was going to happen, but we kept them informed and we constantly if we can, as much as we can, try and express what we think and where we are with things, just on a really basic human level, because I think that's the easiest way of doing it, is to try to be as transparent as possible and trying to be as candid and honest about what you believe, because there's so many different ways of doing things. And the idea is, on the left and right and you know, up and down, there's many ways people want things to be. But when you're a team together, you have to aggregate all those ideas into what serves everybody rather than the individual. And that's what how I always think about it. It's like, we try and listen to everyone, aggregate that and express what we think is the best thing based on all of those people. And I think if you do that, you'll be better off, I think.
So at the core, I've heard a lot about people. You design for people. You worry about the people that are on your team and how to best set the team up for success. Can you talk about your how you approach your work based on the people that you're trying to serve?
Yeah, I suppose the first thing is you try and become a fan of the company or the brand. So you want to fall in love with the brand that you're creating with, and you want to humanize that. So we go meet people. If it was AC Milan, for example, we go to Milan, we meet the you know, the Milanese people, the Rossoneri fans, we meet the club, the grounds people. You know, you meet as many people as possible and you try and soak up what matters to them, as well as the leadership of the company. And the more that you listen to real people, the more you pick up on themes around areas that matters to them. And of course, every brand is different. And what you're looking for is distinction. You're looking for difference between one brand and another. And of course, that culture, those values, those ideas, so are what drives the work. So if we listen to people, it means we're just trying to have a degree of authenticity and reality to what we design. Because it's easy to say, I think it should be red, it should be blue, I like this, I like that. But if you do that, you're just designing for yourself, and we're commercial artists. So I'd rather hear what other people think. And the best way of doing that is actually meeting them. And we do that quite a lot.
So you just touched on the AC Milan work that you did. Can we dive into that a little bit more? And can you explain how you landed on the deliverables that you landed on with the custom typeface and how you built out the look and the feel? Because it wasn't just for motion or graphic design. It was a broad spectrum rebrand for them.
I suppose that is specifically what I was talking about, which is, you know, we were contacted by them. And, you know, to be contacted by someone like AC Milan, it's like being contacted by the Celtics. It's like, it's an idea. It's iconic. You know, it's like there's such resonance and power to that. So you're like, wow, okay, so this is serious. You know, like it's a really amazing thing for you to happen. And it's important to the people you're designing for. It's important to the client. It's important to the club itself. And it's important to all the fans, not just in Milan, but all over the world. There's 450 million AC Milan fans globally. That's a big audience. So we wanted to be sensitive to their history, which is 120 years. It has deep cultural value, as a deep pedigree as one of the world's great sporting brands. But they needed retooling for the future, because their growth is going to come from America and Malaysia and China as much as it is in Italy. They're already a super brand in Italy. But of course, you've got to balance those two realities, which is somebody who's in the stadium has a very different experience of AC Milan to somebody who's in Malaysia who might only wear the jersey or understand the players. And it's that relationship you've got to figure out. It's a bit like a Ferrari fan might wear a cap somewhere, a Ferrari cap. They might never drive a Ferrari, let alone own one. So it means different things to different people. So what we look at is how we build a relationship with people, not just in the stadium, but the best of Milan, the best of Italy, and then out into the world and what that means. The other thing we didn't want to do is just do a lookalike sports branding project. It's very easy to fall into the kind of cliche of a particular industry. And for a while, sports branding was very, very similar. Very aggressive, shiny, very, you know, a bit one-dimensional. So we wanted to draw on the culture of lifestyle, fashion, the ideas that drive the Milanese culture, as well as, you know, the heartbeat of AC Milan. And again, a lot of that came from talking to the people there. And then we radiated out. And what we found, having talked to the client, was that the actual crest, the badge, is so ingrained in people, the last thing you want to do is change that identity, because that's, you know, 100 years of history. So we decided to change everything else. And that means that we gave voice to the brand. We created devices which allows them to communicate ideas and messaging rather than just logo stamp. It made them digital first so that they could work through social and digital platforms, which is incredibly important to be build narrative and be in the moment. And it kind of creates a journey, you know, how everything connects from the stadium to digital to, you know, how it sounds to the way they might market versus merchandising and licensing, to their foundation, to the PR, to all of the kind of cultural things they do. And you're building an ecosystem, and that's what we did. So there's a recipe behind this idea of Sempre Milan, which is always Milan. You're part of something. And we wanted to capture that kind of importance of that spirit and then project it. So every little moment was delightful. Every little moment has a little bit of magic. And you're creating a set of tools and techniques and habits and behaviors and motion and design systems rather than assets. And I think that's the key to good branding.
Yeah. When I found you a couple years ago, the thing that I saw first was your motion theory and understanding the intention with which things were created to move for soccer in particular. You used the free kick and just a whole bunch of actual soccer terminology and movements to dictate the motion within the piece. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I think that's the moment that was super fascinating to me, where I had a light bulb go off just from seeing the work that you were sharing, to be able to go, okay, well, they're putting so much detail and attention to all of these elements to make them fit together that it was really impressive to me.
Thank you. It's really kind of you to say so. I suppose we've always had a history of caring about the details. So for example, about 15 years ago, we did the design system for Formula One. And at the time, we really liked the idea of gamifying how the graphics work so it could make it feel much more immediate and immersive. And the design you're talking about, I think, is the field of play system for the Premier League design that we created. And with that, we had this feeling that sports graphics were very similar. So it was like, you know, boom. It was all very much about attitude and all very surface and all very transient. And football or soccer, sorry, that's like your life. Like it's meaningful to you. It's much deeper than just marketing or graphics. It's something that people really care about. And there's a narrative to that. There's pre-game, there's as the game's happening, halftime, the context of that, the second half, what happens afterwards, the next game. There's a whole story to that. And if it's driven by something, whatever that, whether it's a score clock or the lower third or the yellow card, if there's a design system and a theory that drives that, the audience doesn't necessarily know it, but they can feel it. They feel there's intention to it. There's a human who's made this rather than a computer. And that's what we wanted. And all the decisions were about creating a great experience. So when people watch the football, it connects to them more. The graphics are there when you need them, and then they disappear when you're done. And it gives a really powerful brand attribution to the Premier League or Formula One or AC Milan. But for the end user, the person watching the football game or watching the race, they just feel like they're part of it, and it just works better for them. And again, they don't know we made all this stuff, but they can sure feel it.
That's fantastic. So you've talked a little bit about inspiration of, you know, going to the places and living the experiences as much as you can, talking to the people that live there and integrate yourself in there so you can better understand who you're delivering for. How else do you find inspiration when you first start a project?
It's an interesting question, this one, because I worry a lot about everybody seeing the same pieces of work and seeing the same cultural references, because we can all see everything instantly now globally through social media, Instagram, Behance, you know, various things. Everybody sees everything. So it's how you edit those references and how you remix them to create something new, I think, is a challenge, because the creative process is about assimilating things, letting it float around, and being receptive to the idea appearing. And it's that magic of imagining an idea rather than finding an idea, I think, is the key. Lots of people, when they design, they go collect loads of things they've seen and say, it feels like this. But of course, everybody can do that. And what that happens is it's an aggregation of existing ideas. So it's much harder to move on. You're more likely to fall into trends or derivative work if you do that. So yes, of course, you need to be influenced by what's happening in the world, but I would be influenced beyond design. I'd look at music and fashion and life and things beyond that to influence me as much as anything else. But when it comes to work, it's about imagining something new and putting yourself in a state of mind that all those influences remix into something new based on the specificity of the thing you're designing, not what you saw somewhere else.
I love that. So when you're creating a space for your team, how do you approach that with the inspiration and trying to fit your team together, different people from diverse backgrounds or diverse roles within the organization?
Well, it's kind of like a layer cake. So my job really is to create the space for people to be successful. So I wouldn't be hands-on as much as some people on the project. So I would tend to create the space, the strategies for the business, you know, the direction of it and how we interact with clients and things like that, as opposed to specifically be hands-on on every project. But it's about context setting, which is, why are we doing the work we do? You know, who do we work with? What type of work would we like to achieve? And it goes back to what I was saying earlier, which is actually having explicit conversations about that, which is, look, we're at the end of the year and all of us are stretched out like a piece of toffee or candy after this year. It's like we've been wrung out because it's been a strange, transient year. So it's okay to stop and say, like, what does that feel like? You know, like, how do you become original again? How do you find new influences? How do we get better at what we do? So I think it's just a matter of talking around those things. And then you go back to the things that drive you, which is, what does different look like? You know, why is this project different to the other project? Because this brand is different to this brand. This location is different to this location. This audience is different to this audience. And what it's really about is creating a space for the team to feel safe to do the work they want to do. And when I mean safe, I mean, I don't mean physically safe from like burglars and fire. I mean mentally safe to be more dynamic in their creative thinking. And that's what we try and do. And we constantly have to strive to do better on their behalf. It's, you know, it's the thing that worries me the most is, well, it's two things. One is making sure they're all healthy and covered and protected. But the other is, how do we give them the space to express themselves creatively? Because I don't want people to design like me. I want them to design like themselves. And it's a mixture of all those things, different writers, strategists, designers, and the producers mixing together and talking that creates the magic. And our job is to create the space for that to happen.
When you're starting a project, do you've talked a little bit about setting the strategy and being the person to outline the direction in some sense. Do you start with a brief or anything along those lines to start those conversations and better make sure you're understanding the objectives with your client?
Yeah, definitely. So when we first meet the client, we'll often have conversations with them about, you know, we'll be contacted all in some fashion by somebody and say, we've got this problem. And usually there's a brief that goes with that, but often there's a much less explicit but deep-rooted problem behind the brief. And there's loads of reasons you get a brief. Moving into new territory, a new brand, reaching a new audience, rebranding to better connect, need to be more digital, there's more competition. It's usually a transition to make the business stronger or the company stronger in some sense, or engage in a better way with their audience or maximize the potential of that relationship. So that's what we look for. And our first stage is called initiate, which is really questioning the brief. It's like asking why the brief exists. We also talk explicitly ourselves about what's the opportunity for Dixon Vaccine in the project? What can we bring to the table that's different? Because we need to bring something that, you know, is original and different and differentiates us. So we talk about that. And that fuels our conversation with the client. And we just try and understand the stresses and strains that are on them, because most clients have very responsible, high-end jobs. They've got they need to deliver against the brief. And our job is to help them do that. And it's almost like you're taking the weight off their shoulders temporarily to have a more open and relaxed conversation about, look, imagine what we could do. Really, is this the thing we need to do? And a lot of it's just listening to them. We do a huge amount of listening early on before we project in anything out, because I think it's so easy to turn up with preconceptions of what you think should be changed. and imagine that you have all the answers because you're a great agency. But it doesn't work like that. You have to listen to people and really get under the skin of what they're saying to you. Then you look at the brief, then you decide how to tackle a project, then you go about the process.
So I assume you ask a lot of questions, though, as part of that process, as you're listening.
Oh, shit, yeah. I ask questions all the time.
So,
I mean, I ask questions when I'm looking at the work, you know, and there's no better way of talking to people and trying to simplify the questions, which is, you know, what does success look like? Do you think this is original? You know, those types of questions, which are very broad range and get actually very specific answers from different people. So what you want to do is try and ask people questions which don't trip them up, which allow them to have voice, because that's the key to collaboration and really creating great work.
I'm putting my leadership hat on and I've, you know, there's a lot of books and people out there talking about, you know, you should be a coach when you're leading your team. And so you just highlighted a couple questions, but how do you approach feedback when you're working with your team and asking some of those questions?
I ask them what they think first. So there's lots of ways of doing it. It depends on your style as a creative director. Or I don't like the term leadership. It's similar as entrepreneur. It feels weighted to me, and it creates a thing which is one person is superior to the other. And I think when we're talking about creativity, I like to level the playing field. Obviously, I would carry more gravitas than certain other people because I'm Dixon of Dixon Baxter, blah, 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 and I'm experienced. But as much as possible, you want to ask people why they did what they did, what they see in the work, what's driving the ideas of the work, why do they think it worked, what do they think's missing? And then you want other people to talk about the work in the same way with objectivity, which is what is working and what isn't, why is it working? And try and get underneath things that as much as possible so that everybody has voice. Because when you're working together, some people are more gregarious and outgoing and others are more quiet. And you've got to give everyone space. So I tend to, as much as possible, ask them what they believe. And then I move the conversation to, in a sense, repeat the things I've heard and see if they line up to create the next version of the brief to take the work on. And if something's missing, I'll try and focus in on that and say to them, look, I've heard this, this, and this, but potentially we're missing something. Can you see anything that's missing? And see if they can see it themselves before I tell them. And then if not, I'll help them spot maybe some blind spots.
How have you seen that method of how you approach the feedback work for future then? Because it sounds like what you're doing is not only setting up to get them to critically think about the work as they're doing it, but you're doing that for future work as well, so that they exactly. think about it more as they go.
Exactly. It's exactly that, which is it's teaching a person to fish rather than giving them a fish. Because I could give you the answer. I could walk into any, well, not any, that sounds arrogant. I don't mean like that, but I could walk into pretty much any creative session and go, that, do this, do that, do that. And it would improve it instantly. That's one of the skills of being very experienced at being a creative director or running an agency. But if you want somebody to create brilliantly when you're not there, you need to teach them the habits and the critical thinking and the way that I would approach it. And when I say I approach it, I mean the critical thinking part of it, not the style of how I would design something. So you're teaching them longer-term career skills and ways of being more open, receptive, critical. In the most positive sense of that, you need radical honesty and transparency. You need to let every voice be heard. You need to judge your work on lots of different merits. You need to look at it from your perspective, the client's perspective, the person you're designing it from. And you've got to keep putting yourself in a mindset of not laying things out, but creating things that you understand why they work the way they do. So I try and transfer those skills either directly to the creative team or via the leadership team to the creative team.
Why do you think that's hard for people to do when they're walking in and not going, do this, 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 and this?
Why do I think it's different? Why do I think people go and do this, this, and this?
I think what you're talking about is pretty rare as far as, in my experience, it's pretty rare that somebody has the ability to almost sit back and help other people grow and improve. as opposed to dictating how things should move along, because it, you know, they get it done quicker.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You do get it done quicker initially, but long term you don't. So it bites you in the ass, because what happens is you think you're creating a system where everything's super efficient, you're on it, blah, blah, blah. But then you're still doing it a year later and a year later. If you teach a person how to critically think, their career will develop faster and you can move on to something else. You know, you can have a lighter touch. And I think that's the key to being a great creative director, is the lighter touch you can have, the better. If you're telling people how to create, then the process is broken. It's also not very good for the person who's creating, because they're like, shit, man. It's like, I trust people. You know, it's like I learned by doing. So maybe that's how I see it. But I'd rather create for the space for someone to find how they want to create and tell them. It's just not a very, doesn't feel very collaborative to me. I don't know why other people do it that way. Time's probably one thing. They've maybe not been trained, another. They followed somebody else who did the same style. They believe it's a cool way of doing it. I find myself finding it hard to bite my tongue. I'm a bit chatty at the best of times. So I do have to remind myself to shut up.
Oh, that's good. No, I'm just trying to think of, you know, thinking back to when you were mentioning leadership. I hadn't really heard anybody say that leadership was a word that they didn't really like. Like, as far as management goes, or like trying to make yourself feel important, or make sure that everybody knows that you're the person who's making all the decisions and that kind of stuff. When it comes to creativity and making sure that the voices are heard, it sounds like there's just a lot of room and collaboration and capabilities for people on your team to have the space to, you know, make themselves heard.
Exactly. And you have to help them do that. I mean, I'm a great believer. If you have to tell people and show that you're the leader, you're not a leader. It's like, if you don't have the confidence in your abilities and your position in the company, and you have to keep reminding people that you're the person who's in charge, then you have a really fucked up system, I think. You know, so obviously my name is Dixon and I own an agency called Dixon Baxi. So it's incredibly easy for me to say that. But I think you have to wear your responsibility in your leadership if you are going to be a leader lightly. You need to lead when it's hard. Like, you know, when COVID happened, you know, my job is to take the shit. My job is to take all the difficult stuff, the hard stuff, the things that are dangerous and difficult to our agency, and protect people from that. That's what my job is. And then create the space for them to create. And the only reason I worry about things like leadership and entrepreneurship and all that stuff is, in the general culture of our industry, those terms have become kind of meaningless, because people ascribe to a certain way of being and of carrying themselves. But the very best people I've ever met just do their jobs brilliantly, and they don't worry about all the other stuff. And they're really, truly creative people, the ones who really train and mentor people to the next level. And of course, like I say, it's easy to say if you're at the top of the tree, but I do think it's important to try and carry it as lightly as possible.
You mentioned the pandemic and dealing with some of that. You've shifted how you've approached your work from home and work in the office. Can you talk a little bit about how the pandemic has changed how you and the team operate, and how you operate now that things have opened up a little bit more?
Yeah, for sure. As with everybody, the immediate impact was very hard, and it was very uncertain and very stressful, not just in terms of work-wise, but for people's mental health. So, you know, we've always had the ability to work remotely with clients. So 80% of our work's international. It has been since we started the agency. So working remotely on video conferencing and various softwares to do that, that part of it's fine. We've been doing that for a long time. But the uncertainty and the intensity with which that's happened, i.e. we're always on video chats and everybody's just slammed into this kind of wall of technology, it was really unsettling. So what we did was we focused on the habits and rituals of how we work and why we work, rather than a technology that facilitates that. So I don't give a damn whether it's Zoom, Teams, Google, whatever. I really don't care. What I care about is why we're having a conversation, how we're working. And I think if you root around that, you get to something that's more meaningful, so it's less stressful. We did lots of things like we tried to ease workload. We turned work down. because it got very busy. We took a paid week off for everyone to just relax. We put things in place for people's mental health. So we have different companies who can support anonymously people who are going through maybe difficult times because of the situation. So we tried to put a lot of things in place like that. And then as we come out of it, we are currently doing Monday, Tuesday is flexible. You can come into the studio or work from home or anywhere you want for that matter. And then Wednesday, Thursday, we're all in the studio together. And then Friday is flexible again, but we're trying not to work Friday afternoons to create more kind of airtime. We have some periods where we have no Slack, so we can switch off and fewer meetings, things like that. And what we believed was we needed to rebuild the cultural and social glue of the team. So we asked the team and we said, look, we believe for a few months at least, we all need to come in for a number of days together, because if it's completely random, we won't get that social traction we need to create the work we create. But the rest of it will be flexible. And that's what we've trialed. And so far, it's going really well. We've rebonded as a team, but not that we ever fully unbonded, but we've rebonded as a team. But it's great that people don't have to commute on a Monday morning and a Friday night. And it's just greater degree of flexibility. And I think the more we embrace that, the better. I don't think we'll ever be a fully remote company, because we believe in human interaction and we believe in the kind of tribal nature of creativity. That doesn't mean it's right or wrong. It's just how we see the world.
So you had mentioned earlier that you had just hit 20 years recently within the last couple months.
Yeah.
Over the extended period of time that you've been an agency owner, is this the most challenging time, or is it just another time that has come up that you've had to face that's different just because of the time frame that we're in and the technology and capabilities that are out there?
This is the most profound situation I've ever been in. So I've run agencies for 32 years, and I've been in agencies during 9/11, you know, the dot-com bubble bursting, several recessions in the UK, very different, you know, a massive transition of how technology changes the way you work, the cultural changes, you know, of how you look after people and the way that work works. So yes, there's been a lot of changes, but this lockdown, certainly March, April, May, June last year, was the most profound situation I've ever come across in all my time working. But we do build the business to be strong. So we're financially strong, specifically to be okay when things are difficult. I want Dixon Baxi to be an entity that is strong when things are good and bad. So all the time I've ever had agencies, I've built them to work when things are bad as well as when they're good. And that has helped us. But yeah, you just can't account for something like being locked down for that length of time. It's just so, so unusual. But I'm very optimistic as a person. And the fact that we found a vaccine, the world came together, figured out, I know it was a bit confusing, but within an 18-month period, I found a way of getting through this. It's pretty amazing. And it shows human endeavor and creativity at its best, I think. So nothing is perfect, and it's been an awful, tragic period. But I do look forward optimistically, because I think that's the best way of looking at things.
In our pre-screening questions, I asked you about hobbies away from your job, and maybe since because of the COVID and things that you were, you know, having to be at home a little bit more than you were used to. You said you escaped by reading nonfiction for big ideas and thinking. Can you talk a little bit about why you read and what you read?
Yeah, there's a number of reasons. One is, as you develop your career, it's very easy to think you know everything. And what's so great about, fiction as well, I do read fiction, but particularly nonfiction, I read a lot of science, cosmology, you know, things that are kind of big ideas, the drivers of what we are as people and our history and the way that we look at the world in general. And I find that inspiring, because it's the purest form of creativity. You know, when a cosmologist is looking at the universe, the fundamental questions of that don't get much deeper. And when you think about, you know, the really powerful change makers of you know, human creativity and endeavor, when you think about science, chemistry, biology, and the things that make the world a better place, including the arts and, you know, the positive things in our history, they just open your mind in a way that watching a box set on Netflix doesn't. Not that I don't. I've almost finished Netflix, to be honest, in the last 18 months. But I like it as a way of making me think differently. I also like the idea of physically, tactically, the tactility of reading a book, because I spend so much time on a screen. Going somewhere else to read actually changes my mind state. I go running and do other things, you know, to keep myself physically fit. But I treat my mind the same way. I need to exercise my mind to make me a better thinker, I think. And some of that rubs off on my leadership. If I do lead in any way, I do read about that side of things as well. But I tend to read that historically rather than the latest cool leadership book.
Yeah, I love that. And so when you're talking about creativity, your background, your willingness to share, how does that define you as a person?
It makes me happy. So there's lots of metrics. You know, life is quite complicated and it has lots of ups and downs. And having a sense of place in the world and an identity and feeling validated in what you do is really important, I think. And I've always found creative expression and the fact that I work in the creative industries is a big definer for me in my life. It makes me feel solid and confident and placed in the world. And I think that particularly the moment, that's really important. So yeah, it helps define who I am. And I know there's a lot of conversation about work-life balance, but I don't see it like that. I create because I want to, and I love doing it. And I invest as much time as I want to feel like I'm doing that well on my terms. And that makes me happier than if I didn't do that.
You started the Dixon Baxey Way as a way to share your approach with in a video form, because you've done that in many other forms as well. And I'm curious just to hear from you why you share so much and why it matters to you to make sure that other people can see how you're doing things in the world.
I suppose at my stage of career, I've been very fortunate to have done a lot of different things and achieve a lot of both life and career goals. And I think it's important to give something back. It's important to share the journey, and because there's an awful lot of nonsense in the industry about ways of working, and there's a kind of cloud of nonsense about aspiring for greatness and all the things that's why I react to things like leadership and entrepreneurship and stuff like that, which is this magic bullet of having this awesome career and this title and this money and all this kind of stuff. And none of it matters if you're not making the work you want to make. And none of it matters if you're not self-determined and following a path that suits you as either an individual or collective. So I've always felt that there's just too much negativity. There's too much negativity in terms of people pulling people down, looking at difference as a bad thing. And I don't like that. So I decided a long time ago just to openly and as candidly as possible and as optimistically as possible, just share what I've experienced. And hopefully it might inspire somebody who is on their career journey to take a risk to do the things they want to do rather than follow the traps of the industry. And I'd like, if it's possible, to help the bottom line of the industry, the baseline of the industry, to be more diverse, open, and easier for people to enter our industry, because there's so many different ways of being creative. So I think that's probably the main reason.
If you were to go back to your, I think you recently posted a picture of you at a desk and kind of said, this is where it started, right?
Yeah.
What advice would you give to people who are early in their careers, who are just getting going, to be bold and be brave and make the career that they want to make in creativity?
Yeah, I mean, it's down to your own mindset. There's so many different ways of doing it. But for me, taking risks and doing things the way I wanted to and the way we want to is worth it, because the end result is what I want, is the type of work I want to create and the way I want to create it. So when I started out, my very, very first business, I worked three other jobs to make money so I didn't have to compromise in doing terrible work. So I would only do work that I thought was cool, but which didn't pay that much money initially because I wasn't very good. So I did cleaning jobs and all sorts of other things to pay my wages until I had enough money based on the type of work I wanted to make. And when we started Dixon Baxi, we started with nothing. We had no clients. We didn't go to any existing clients. And we just wanted to do it the way we wanted to. So we'd rather stay small with low overheads, with low maintenance, very simple, to just do the work we want. And it's a series of thousands and thousands of steps that build to a career that's successful. And you've just got to make sure that each time you take a step, is it going in the direction you want it to? Are you making the work you want to? If you're not, stop, think about that. And can you change it? And that's why I always say, don't chase titles, don't chase money, don't chase what other people tell you success is. Chase the thing that matters to you in terms of how you want to create. And when you look back 20 years down the line, you're much more likely to be happy, I think. You'll get paid well as well. If you get good, you'll get paid well. If you get good, you'll get a good title. If you get good, you'll work with great clients. But it just takes time.
You touched on something there, and this can be my last question that I like to ask people is, you just mentioned cleaning and having three jobs so that you could afford to do what you wanted to do, how you wanted to do it. Is there anything that you learned in a job before you got into working in an agency or design that you still carry with you today that has impacted how you approach what you do and how you do it?
Yeah, in fact, it's a really good question. I suppose a couple of things. One is hard work. I don't think you can cheat putting effort in to get what you want. Don't burn out. Don't put the time in into things you don't want to do. But if you want to achieve something, hard work is worthwhile. It keeps you grounded. And also, having done other jobs like that, it does keep me grounded, which is I remember what that felt like. And I remember that type of work is really hard. It requires huge effort to do those types of work. So I'm very lucky to do what I do. And it helps me not forget that, I think.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions, so pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're enjoying this podcast, we'd love it if you shared it with a friend or a coworker and leave us a 5-star rating so other people will be able to find us as well. And don't forget to subscribe so that you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.